again, we are discussing in the book of Ecclesiastes a point of view that is stated in verse 1 and 2 of the text, actually verse 2, where the writer says, "Vanity of vanities, all is vanity." We emphasized in our study last week that the point of view of the book, at least a good portion of it, is as described here, life that is lived under the sun or under heaven. I forget not exactly how many times those phrases are used. I think in the New King James, under the sun is used 30 times, under heaven 3. But I did a search and last week, and it didn't quite coincide with that. It was like 27 and 2, so I'm not exactly sure where the discrepancy is. But again and again in the text, as he talks about the vanity of life, the point is made that this is life that is lived without God in the picture. And that's kind of the thing that we need to keep in front of our minds, at the front of our minds as we look through this material. Otherwise, we will find messages in it that seem to be contradictory to Christian values. And we've already made some note of that in the past, but we'll be bringing that up from time to time. So in our discussion, we talked about the pessimism of the writer, his point of view, and indicated that this is somewhat a literary device that he's using. It's not his actual point of view, which is evident when you get into the 12th chapter. He comes to a conclusion and understands that life is best lived with God in the picture. But to establish that point, he talks about the vanity of life without God. And so when you look at these statements, what you have is something that is extremely pessimistic in outlook. And it's something that is obviously so. Despairing, there are cries of worthlessness, of a lack of value with regard to things that we consider to have some importance. And so keeping in mind that device, you'll note at the top of page 3 the statement that Solomon was wrong. And it's not right for us to say that Solomon was wrong in his final conclusion, because he was right in his final conclusion. But when he was talking about how life should be viewed pessimistically, that's not the case, and that's not the way that we as Christians view it, because we have God in the picture. But without God in the picture, then certainly this pessimism is something that's warranted. So that's of course the point of view that is being expressed here. So what we talked about, we actually fairly quickly went over the concept of human existence and human wisdom under letter B there on page 2. These are the things that we began a discussion of, and I wanted to take my time and go through those. But the first and second bullet, he actually does enlarge upon. That makes it the remainder of the lesson. So that means that we talked in a little bit more detail about human pleasure, and point as established when you look at all of the things that he made for himself, all of the things he indulged in. Chapter 2 and verse 4, he said, "I made my works great. I built myself houses, planted vineyards, made myself gardens and orchards, and planted all kinds of trees and water pools." You know, again, those of you who do garden and or want to make an oasis of your backyard, you kind of are aware of the joy that can come from that. But he expresses it as something that was vain. And the reason for that is because all that you accomplish and all you strive to do, ultimately you understand that those things are fleeting. They're ephemeral. They're not something that lasts. And the same thing with regard to human labor in chapter 2 and verses 19 through 21. And the interesting thing about that is, again, the concept of progeny, that often you'll have people who will strive hard through the entirety of their life in an attempt to accomplish something for their family, and then their family squanders it. And the vanity of that is something that is evident. Make sure that I am recording that. So that gets us to the next point, which is human rivalry, which is where we're beginning today. So look at chapter 4 and verse 4. Would someone like to read chapter 4 and verse 4 for me? Patsy, would you please?
Again, I saw that for all toil and every skillful work, man is envied by his neighbor. This also is vanity and grasping for the wind.
Now, again, there are some specific points that are made with these that actually you have something. There's something to be said in 2 and verses 19 through 21 of that kind of laboring and accomplishing the building of things that is a little bit different than the lesson that is found here in chapter 4 and verse 4. But it is something that is evident, is that with everything that we seek to accomplish, even things that could be construed as positive, there are sometimes negative consequences that are ascribed to that. Just right before coming over here, I was on the computer and came across a link with regard to James Garfield, who was one of our presidents and who was a Christian. And of course, you can't say that with most of our presidents, if not all of them except for him. He was actually a gospel preacher and during the Restoration Movement. He once said he stepped down out of the pulpit into the presidency, indicating that the work he was doing before was more important than the work he was taking on as president. But I was reading about his life a little bit. Of course, we don't know much about it because he was killed while in office and didn't serve very long. But that was the peculiar thing about that, is here was a man who had dedicated himself to the cause of Christ and striving to live righteously and morally and treat men as they should be treated, and someone assassinated him because he didn't like him. Yeah, and so there are always consequences to what we do. So you think about it in that context. Chapter 4, verse 4 is a situation or circumstance where you have a man who is accomplishing great things. But in accomplishing those great things, he's also eliciting envy in others as a result of that. And so, you know, what we contemplate, if we're contemplating life that is lived without respect to God, is how is it that I can best call my life a success if God's not in the picture? And someone would say, well, if I were to accomplish things by building something or by this idea of toiling and working and being skilled at what I do, that's something that will give me value. But at the same time, it brings conflict. And so again, everything, even things that we might particularly claim to be positive things and attributes, it's going to bring opposition. It's going to be bring conflict. And ultimately, what he's saying is that if that's what you're looking for to be the way in which you get this fulfillment, then chances are you're going to be unsatisfied because there's going to be heartache that accompanies it. And I think that's kind of the lesson with all of these things. But the interesting thing to talk about in regard to this is the way in which human nature works, to where humans have that tendency to be envious. Envy is a real problem. It's certainly something that is described in Scripture as sinful and something we should strive to refrain from, coveting what another has, being envious of another's accomplishments. That's not supposed to be what we as Christians are, but it certainly is characteristic of the world. And so, again, this is rightly construed as something that is vain.
I've heard all my life, I guess, keeping up with the Joneses, which is the same principle.
Yeah, how is it that you get something, and, well, which is the point of view here, so you get something or you accomplish something. Why in the world would that make someone unhappy with you and oppose you? But at the same time, I think that each of us, if we're honest with ourselves, will have recognized and acknowledged that kind of reaction to the success of another at some time in our life. Somebody gets something or does something and it makes us feel like, man, you know, even if it's just if it's not necessarily a sinful thing, but just, I wish I was that way, or I wish I could accomplish that, or why did he get that and I don't? You know, those kinds of things are kind of natural inclinations that we have. And that's what he's talking about, is the natural inclination of man, unregenerate man. How are they going to react to it? And the point is, again, from this point of view, that if you're thinking that this is something that's going to give you joy, lasting purpose in life, that's a vain pursuit as well. simply because of the reaction of others to it, that that's going to be problematic. So human rivalry is one vain thing in life.
And I looked at that word about envy too. I came across the verse about how envy is what led Jesus to the cross in Matthew. I forget the verse, Matthew 24. I can't memorize it. You probably know it. But.
Okay. Yeah. So how is that?
Well, they didn't want him taking over.
Yeah. So that's an interesting thing. Really, the concept of jealousy, envy, and covetousness, all those are so closely intertwined that it's sometimes difficult to differentiate in regard to the words. But that is certainly a central response, a worldly, earthly response to the successes of others, and it's certainly something that should not be present. It's actually one of our discussion questions that we can kind of touch on. If you'll go over, let's see where that is. Passage that I wanted to look at because I wrote it down. Maybe I was thinking just of the idea of... Oh, I know where it is. Yeah, okay. Question number five. Laugh and the world laughs with you. Cry and you cry alone. That's something, again, that is typical of the world. So we're familiar with that statement. He said the opposite may be true, as there seems to be more sadness than happiness these days. In other words, laugh and you laugh alone, cry and you cry with everyone else, is the way he puts it. But he says, in what way should God's people be different? And the passage that I wanted to make note of is 1 Corinthians chapter 12 to answer this. 1 Corinthians 12. And notice in this particular context, beginning in verse 12, he's discussing the fact that we're all different members of the same body. And equally important in the eyes of God, though some are less seemly, and as such are more in need. But I want you to notice, because of the fact that we all are members together, the statement that is made in verse 25 and following, first of all, that there should be no division. We should have the same care for one another. And he illustrates that in verse 26 by saying that if one member suffers, all members should suffer with it. And if one member is honored, then all members should rejoice with it. And this is an indication of the same care. So the imperative that we've talked about many times that should indicate the type of life we're to live as Christians is the imperative of love, always seeking what's best for others. And this is a part of that imperative of love, is that when an individual is suffering because we desire what's best for them and we have that affinity for them, then we're going to be unhappy as well. If they're suffering, we're suffering. That's the way it should be. Because then we're mindful, and since we're empathetic, we're going to seek to alleviate their suffering. And the same thing is true of the opposite. It is inappropriate for me as a Christian when my brother or sister in Christ has reason to be rejoicing. They have received some honor, the accolades of others. It's unseemly for me to be upset about that, envious of it. That's antithetical to the imperative of love that is supposed to be governing our lives. So instead, the proper response for us as Christians when that happens is for us to rejoice and be happy at their good fortune. And that's not an easy thing to do. That is something, again, is characteristic of the higher calling that should be characteristic of us as Christians. So that's kind of what we're talking about here, is that the worldly response is envy. And so as a result of that, even if my own good accomplishments brings the hatred or the enmity or the jealousies of others into my life, then why in the world would I want to gain glory or honor if it's going to lead to other people disliking me or being unhappy with me? So that itself is vain. So that's the reason why that is. All these responses are worldly responses, but they are something that are characteristic responses, something that you see over and over and over and over again. which is why you have so many successful people who are unhappy. They're unhappy because others are jealous of them. They're unhappy because they are jealous of someone who's even more successful than they are, or that kind of rivalry that exists, and it's certainly inappropriate. Just kind of a silly illustration of this, but there's a reality that exists in Odessa, Texas, based on the two high schools. I'm talking about human rivalry. That's a rivalry, and of course high schools had that rivalry. Unfortunately, in Odessa, the rivalry has led to very lopsided results over the years. Permian High School has been much more successful in football than Odessa High School, which is where I went. And at one point in time, there were like 36 years in a row that Permian beat OHS. And OHS had some good teams. They just didn't have as good a team as Permian. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, that even since I graduated in 1980, that OHS has only won two or three games in that period of time. Even though Permian's not the power it once was, they still win all the time. And it irks people. I mean, there is a lot of antagonism that exists in Odessa, Texas, even to this day. And if you go on the Facebook class page, class of 1980 OHS, whenever the Odessa Permian game comes up, there's a lot of angst that is present on the part of the Broncos, because we never can seem to beat Permian. And that kind of rivalry leads to envy, and it's a silly thing, but it just angers people. It really does. And you have OHS students that grew up, had kids, and their kids went to Permian, and they're considered traitors because they let their kids go to Permian just because they moved across town. You know, it's a peculiar thing. And if you think if that kind of strong, visceral response would come from something that is just absolutely of no value or importance at all, then that you can kind of see where human nature goes, and that's an unfortunate thing. So there is always that striving that exists among those who are worldly minded, and as a result of that, any success you receive, some are going to be objecting to it and have problems with it, and so there's vanity found in that as well.
And I thought it was pathetic that in that town, which is all y'all growing up and for so long, that the adults were so mad. It was almost like Lee's side of town, Permian side, had a haughtiness about them. We're better than you are.
Yeah.
Through their children playing football, you know. And then, of course, I'm sure there was someone on our side that were worse than
ways. Maybe our perception of their haughtiness was cut a little bit by that envy. Yeah.
But it was there.
I was young at the time. Of course, by the time I got to be an adult, I was pretty much gone from there. But I'll tell you, I think that there was some antagonism that existed between the churches as a result of that as well.
Really?
Just not on par on everybody, but I'm just saying, I think that there was just a little bit of that was present. It's a peculiar thing, but it just shows you how human nature can be. Anyway, so that's the kind of thing that we're talking about. Okay, go to the next one. Human greed, from chapter 4 and verse 8. Ecclesiastes 4:8. Would someone like to read that for me, please? Thank you, Yvonne.
There is none alone without companion. He has neither son nor brother. There is no end to all his labors.
He's got
his eye satisfied with riches, but he never asks, for whom do I toil and deprive myself of good? This also is vanity and a great misfortune.
Okay. Now, again, there are two points made here. They go along the same line of work. The 2:19 through 21, you have an individual who's working hard, and then his progeny comes by and squanders everything after he dies. So that's vain. Why in the world do you work so hard when you don't know you may have a fool coming up after you? But here's someone who may be considered even a bit more foolish in his actions, in that he is working hard to get something spending his life, and remember what it says here. It says, "For whom do I toil and deprive myself of good?" So here is a man who never asked himself the question, why am I working so hard and not living life and enjoying life? Instead, I'm toiling and I'm laboring and I'm trying to get and I'm trying to obtain and possessions, obtaining possessions through working. This is what's important to me. And I don't even have anybody to give it to when I die. So this is this, and I think rightly so, they're talking about human greed. Just wanting to get so that I have. What's the ultimate value? And of course, the reason why this is vain is because these are temporal things. And so as it is appointed for man once to die, and after this the judgment, what good are those things going to do for you at your death? This is the kind of man that is described by our Lord as one who fared sumptuously, was so successful as a businessman, he made the determination that he would tear down his barns and build greater barns so that he could house his great wealth, and said to himself, "You have goods laid up for many years. Take thine ease, eat, drink." And this the vanity of this is seen in the Lord's response. "You fool, this day your soul will be required." So here's an individual who just wants, and spends his life getting, and the vanity of that is seen in the temporal nature of what he gets. All he's doing is accruing wealth on earth, and ultimately that wealth will benefit him not at all. And so that's a vain pursuit as well. If all there is what's on the earth under heaven. Comments, questions about that one? Human greed. And you know, you also can note other things about that. Is that we talk about the fact that individuals are not satisfied. You go to chapter 5 and verse 10, which is another point here. He who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver. So you're trying to get these possessions, you're working hard to get them, and it turns out when you get them that doesn't fill the void that you're seeking to fill. You'll never be satisfied with that. So there's a number of things that indicate the vanity of wanting and of striving to attain that ultimately it's a vain pursuit as well. So looking at that, there is that... the next two kind of tie in together with this: human greed, human fame, and human wealth. And the interesting thing about fame in chapter 4 and verse 16 is the statement that, and again, maybe this is an indication of himself. Verse 13, "Better a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who will be admonished no more." He comes out of prison to be king, although he was born poor in his kingdom. "I saw the living walk under the sun. They were with the second youth who stands in his place. There was no end of all the people over whom he was made king. And yet those who come after will not rejoice in him. Surely this is also vanity and grasping for the wind." You wonder here in this that he is making a self-reference to this thing that he's realized, that the accolades that he's received as king, the fact that he is sovereign, the fact that he is an individual who can have whatever it is that he wants, and yet he says there will be a generation that will follow who will not rejoice in him. That's something that I've struggled with a little bit. When we consider the lives of those who pass away and go before us, they're still important to us, and we recognize, especially to those who are our own family or those that we're closest to. But life goes on, and you know, as time progresses, the mourning that we experience and that preoccupation that we have with the passing of a loved one, it lessens a bit. And so even those who are closest, they recognize that life goes on, and that void, though it cannot be filled, that the pain lessens somewhat, and we continue on. The rest of the world, it's of no great consequence. It's only those that we're closest to. And so that's why you have even people like, say, your brethren in the church. They're empathetic with you. They understand your loss. Perhaps they've lost their own loved ones. But there is that recognition, nevertheless, that their life goes on. And you know what has gotten me thinking about this just recently is you know, the interaction that you have with doctors. And I see it both when I'm, let's say, when I'm sitting with families and the doctor comes out, or with Debbie, you know, going through her surgeries and all. It's a job for the doctor. I mean, the doctor, if he's a good doctor, he has that empathy. He does it because he wants to help people. But you know, when someone dies on their watch, perhaps they're sorrowful and they may have trouble sleeping that night. But then there's another day and more work, and life goes on. And that's always been the case, and it always will be the case till the Lord comes again. That there's no one who lives who is indispensable, and even no one who lives who's indispensable to another person. Because if that were the case, that when one's life ends, then the lives of others would end as well, and they don't. They go on. So those are hard lessons for us to learn. But consider how difficult it would be for an individual who is important, who is famous, and who has a position of great authority or great power, and how difficult it would be for him to come to that understanding and recognition that if he were to die, life would go on. Someone would take his place. And he would quickly be forgotten. And relatively, that's the case. It's you know, I understand some people maintain fame longer than others. And Solomon's certainly one of them. You know, we talk about Solomon's wisdom. We learn from the example even today. But at the same time, he's considered now by most a literary figure, not this important monarch that he was at the time when he was alive. That's kind of an indication of the vanity of which we speak. How much importance we place upon ourselves. We're the center of our own lives, certainly. It's the way it is. It's our life. But to recognize that we're not the center of anyone else's life. We're only the center of our own life is something that is hard for us to grasp sometimes. But the wise man finally figured it out. He understood that. His name as well. So these are sobering thoughts, but they're important for us to acknowledge and understand, because that gives us, impetus to consider and to accept what he concludes with in Ecclesiastes 12, you know, is to fear God and keep his commandments as man's all. All right, so human fame, human wealth, human greed. Anyone want to add anything to that? That gets us then down to human coveting. Would someone read chapter 6 and verse 9 for me, please?
Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of desire. This also is vanity and grasping for the wind.
Okay. I have to admit that that's a little bit of a difficult phrase, perhaps. Now, the second part of it, this is vanity and grasping for the wind, is characteristic of what we're talking about. There's something that seems to have some value, but in reality it doesn't. So what is he contrasting when he contrasts the sight of the eye, side of the eyes, with the wandering of desires?
Tangible and not tangible to me. Things that can be touched or is proven against what can be something that you strive for that you can't grasp, such as the wind.
Okay. So there then we would be talking about, we could make that application with the physical versus the spiritual. And people trying to get the physical over the spiritual. But, no, that's not right. So we can't do that, because that would get a backward drive.
That's just off the cuff thinking for me. Just something that you can touch is something maybe that's a little bit more permanent than what your own soul might perceive to be permanent. Maybe creation. You can see God permanently through his creation.
Okay. So in order to get the full idea, give me two things then. So we got creation. So, and what would that be contrasted with? Because it's better than what? Can you think something?
Better than our soul's desires, which could be vanity. I mean, which could be wisdom, wealth, fame.
Okay. Okay. So maybe there's a lesson in that, that living simply is better than... Okay, I understand where you're going. I think there's validity to what you're saying. I went a little different.
It may not be valid at
direction.
All.
No, I think there is. I just wanted to flesh it out a little bit. Yvonne, did you have something?
Well, I just was going to say that mine had the, for that word, the lawsuit, had soul instead of desire.
Soul instead of desire?
Yeah.
So what the soul desires. Does yours not say what the soul desires?
I don't know. I just said
purpose is limited in that also. Which I was trying to figure out.
Mine says goes after what the soul desires.
Six
and nine. Wandering of souls.
All right, well, let me just explain to you what I got from this. And then, and I mean, I think that there's some truth to what's being said here. From what I get, though, is the idea of what you can see rather than what... Well, the desire is the key there. But I was looking at it. Let me put it this way. Yep. What I was viewing is the grass is greener syndrome that we have. Mm-hmm. And what comes up to me. And of course, you know, it's under the idea here of human coveting.
Yeah, that's what I forgot, that this is about coveting.
In this particular context. That's where my mind is going with it. And I wanted to use that example, not because I think that Caleb Westbrook and his family was coveting anything, but I just want you to think for a moment about what happened with Caleb and his example. He's desired, coveted in that sense, but not in a negative sense, to go and preach the gospel in Puerto Rico. It's a work that's been precious to him. The first time he went and visited, he didn't know any Spanish. He's learned the Spanish language for the purpose of being able to preach and dedicated himself several years of study just so that he could uproot his family and go down to San Juan, Puerto Rico and join with the brethren there and do a work that others were not willing to do. And man, that's a good thing, and I appreciate that. But I've almost wanted to write him and said, do you ever think maybe you should have waited till November to move? Because he moved down 2 months ago. And now Irma's gone through, and I forget now the name of this new one that's going through the hurricane. It's just, you know, it's just... So he's taken his wife and two children into that situation. Well, in his mind, though, he was living in Melissa, Texas, you know, on the east side of the Metroplex. And he had a nice home. I stayed with him for a day when he had part of a lectureship over there. You know, a new wife and new children, everything in his life was idyllic in that sense, but he had a desire for something that was somewhere else, and he perceived that, and that was something he wanted more than what he had. Again, not inappropriate, but often those kinds of things can be inappropriate, to where you're not satisfied with where you are, you're not satisfied with what you have, you're always thinking of what could be rather than what is. And so when an individual is unhappy, and again, Paul talks about this in Philippians, that I've learned in whatever state I am to be content. When there is not that contentment, instead an individual is not happy with what he has, he wants something else. Well, ultimately what happens is that when you get that something else, that doesn't satisfy. And so there is something to be said with being content with what you see, your situation, circumstance where you are, and to recognize that often that is actually going to be better than what your mind thinks about and describes. There have been a number of times that that's come up in my life. I've been preaching here for about 5 or 6 years, and the church in Greenville, really peculiar thing, it was inappropriate the way they acted, and I haven't really said something about it, but two of the elders actually came to hear me preach because they wanted to offer me a job at that. And it was a congregation of about 200. And a young guy with kids, and they wouldn't ask offer that now. But at the time, you know, growing family, this is kind of the man they wanted, you know, that kind of thing. And so they came to listen to me and asked to speak with me afterwards. So we went into my office, and they actually basically offered me the job while my brethren were out here in the foyer, and just grated at me that he would do this, and you know, basically said, I don't care what you're making, we'll pay you more, you know, that kind of stuff. And I told him I was happy with where I was, wasn't interested in moving. But that was a congregation of over 200 people. And so there were times as time went on where I wondered, you know, what would have happened, what would have been like if I would have gone there. Well, it turns out that congregation doesn't exist anymore. It ceased to exist. They've had divisions, and there were problems in that church, and it just fell apart completely. Which it might not have if I would have been there. Maybe I could have helped. Maybe not. I don't know. But, you know, I know a lot of preachers where the grass is greener at the next place. You know, their problems where they're at, or they're not completely satisfied, and they think that if I went to another church, that things would be better. It never is. The hurricane is, yeah. And sometimes the hurricane is not a natural hurricane. It has a name that's not, it's not always a woman's name either. It could be just about anyone that could cause those kinds of problems. But the point is this, is that that there's something to be said for being content with where you are. And when you're coveting, when you're desiring something, especially when it's something ephemeral, the concept is always better than the reality. And I think that's one of the vanities of life for individuals, always looking for that perfect situation and never finding it because it doesn't exist. And so they're never happy. And there's vanity to be found in that as well. So that one hits close to home because I see so many preachers. It's an interesting thing. You'll have a... Does a preacher ever ask why the other preacher left? And so we've got an opening. I go and visit, and the people are all nice to me. They want me to come, and it seems like such a wonderful situation and circumstance. It's certainly better than that place that I was at before. So I go. Well, why did the guy who was there leave? And chances are either they didn't like him or he didn't like them or something that got led to that. So it's just, the point is that there are problems everywhere. And,
years ago, it seemed like preachers moved about every 3 or 4 years.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. And they're still, I mean, you still have those kinds of things that happen. I'm probably more aware of it than y'all are and all, but you hear preachers talking and that kind of thing. And I've never felt that way, but it certainly is a human reality, that coveting. And of course, I'm personalizing. It's because I'm making applications with regard to my own life. But that's the case always, is that people look for the perfect, and the perfect doesn't exist, when what they have is something that is sufficiently ideal to where if they would just stop looking for something else, they could be happy with what they have. And so that's what I got out of that.
And gratitude, I think, comes in here, and you stop being grateful for what you do have.
Yeah, very much so. And how can you be grateful for what you have if you're always thinking there's something better out there and always looking and wanting that better thing? Yeah.
And that flip coin is apathy. We don't want to be so content that we're so afraid of being covetous that we just are become apathetic.
Yeah, that's completely, yeah, certainly so. Good point. All right, so then that gets us down to the last two. And, you know, these are all equally important here, but the last two I think we can go over fairly quickly. In chapter 7 and verse 6 talks about human foolishness. And it's the passage is, for the like the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of the fool. This also is vanity. And he talked about laughter as madness already, talking about the people who are trying to enjoy life to its fullest. And that's a vain pursuit as well. So that's not what's under consideration here. What's under consideration here is what a fool thinks is funny, or a fool thinks is joyful, or a fool thinks is something that is right and good. And so the contrast, I think, here that we're talking about, and it's one that you'll find throughout the book of Proverbs and all the reading, is how that a foolish individual, his perspectives, his priorities, his point of view, his outlook is skewed. And so you have very foolish people who are very content in their foolishness. You'll see this often. Ultimately, it may ruin their life. But at the time that they're involved in whatever it is something that seems to be good and something that makes them happy. when you talk about sexual immorality and infidelities, when you talk about drunkenness and other kinds of drug use and abuse, gluttony, the pursuit of money, all of the kinds of things that we think of as being worldliness, there's always, it's the way the devil works. He places an enticement before you. And the reason why it is called an enticement is because it's enticing. You see it, and it's something that you want. And you think that is, if you get that, that that's going to make you happier, it's going to fulfill you. And as he says here, human foolishness, it's foolish because it only camouflages the sad end. That those things that you perceive to be of worth, because you're not looking at it from the proper perspective, ultimately end in destruction. So I think that the lesson to be learned there is the danger of being foolish. And the way in which you scripturally would describe being foolish is having a point of view or an outlook on life that differs from the reality of God. And so that describes an awful lot of people. People look at us. I remember Josh, when he was in a baseball team in high school, we have a conversation with him and I about the view that the rest of the baseball team had about his faith and how he was having to leave practice early, and there were certain things that he couldn't do and certain things he wouldn't involve himself with the rest of the players. And they couldn't understand it. They just shake their heads. They think it's just so stupid. That's the word. Of course, they're teenage boys, so that's the word they would use, is stupid or dumb or you're an idiot or those kinds of things. And it wasn't necessarily mean-spirited. They were joking with and kidding with him an awful lot, but they didn't perceive the value of what it was he was doing. They thought they were the ones that got it right and were enjoying themselves and doing things that he couldn't in good conscience do. But that's a perspective, a point of view that is without respect to God under heaven. They weren't concerned about what God thinks or how it impacted their relationship with God. And I think that's, again, the way the world looks. And so you have, just as an example on TV, American Idol, and I know that it's kind of run its course, but America's Got Talent, all those different type of things, where you have these thousands and thousands of people that are going to try out because they think that they're going to get fame, and this is what's important to them, and they're striving to this, and that's the way I'm going to be happy. And if they would just look at all the famous people and unhappy they are, but they don't look at it that way. And so they, all they see is what the success is, and they see the fan worship, and they see the adulation that is given, and they don't recognize the end of that. They don't see the end. And so that idea of camouflaging the end, I think, is good. The reason why humans are so foolish is because Satan has deceived them into thinking that these things ultimately have some value or worth when they don't. And the unfortunate thing is when you get God's people that start acting in the same way, changing their priorities or faltering in their faith because they have bought in to what the devil's selling. And that's truly a foolish thing. There's one particular individual that I've got in mind a number of years ago that basically gave up his wife and his family for an illicit affair, lost his faith, all of those kinds of things. And he just so enamored with this woman that it colored his thinking and it destroyed his life. And chances are now he would tell you it did. But he didn't see it at the time, for sure. So that's I think, what we get there from that point, at least what the writer wanted to bring out, is the idea of camouflages what is the ultimate end of those who engage in foolishness. And then finally, chapter 8, verse 14. Human rewards. The vanity of this. So here I am trying to live right. And by the way, without God in the picture, who knows what's right and what's wrong. But But there are people who have this perception of what's right and what's good, be honest, those kinds of things. So what happens when you do that? Well, just men, what happens to them is according to the wicked. In other words, you would suspect the wicked to get punished, but instead the just men are getting punished. And then the wicked men, to whom it happens according to the work of the righteous. So you'll hear people say this, why should I work hard and have an honest job when it's not getting me anywhere? And this joker over here, he's cutting corners and breaking laws, and he's getting by with it, and look at how he's proper and I'm not. It's not fair. And that's where I think this particular point goes, is that life isn't fair. And so if you try to live a life so that you'll be rewarded for being right and just, it doesn't work that way. It's vain. So this is one of those places where you have to say, you got to remember the point of view, because Solomon isn't saying, since the righteous are rewarded according to the wicked, and the wicked are recording like as if they were righteous, then go ahead and live wicked lives. He's not saying to do that. But what he's saying is that if punishment and reward is as it is on earth, if that's all there is, then it's vain. It's a vain life. Because you do. You see wicked people who prosper all the time. And the righteous don't. You know, and again, it may be getting a little political don't know, don't care who you voted for in regard to the presidential election. But the amazing thing to me in that previous election was seeing how Donald Trump, as boorish as he was, and with regard to his so-called professions of faith, how obvious it was that spiritually he had absolutely no mooring at all and no desire to be moored spiritually. That despite that, everything he said, people wanted to hear it. You know, he managed to get elected despite all those obvious narcissistic failings that are present in his life. And I just look at him as an example of a wicked man who's really been successful despite his wickedness. He's not the only one. Most politicians, or a lot of politicians, are that way. But it, you know, those kinds of things are rather peculiar to me, that you see that so often. But that's the way the world works, again. So if that's all there is, then that's vanity. If you think that you're going to be rewarded by the world because you're a good person, you're mistaken. Then it doesn't work that way. All right, I probably shouldn't have brought in the political quote, but he just irks me. That man irks me. And I didn't want the other one elected either, but he irks me. Okay, so looking at those numbers of bullet points, anybody have anything you want to add to that? Any of those?
I did make one point about the human rivalry, about God being a jealous God, and that He rivals for us that way, and that way He does. That kind of rivalry is the kind that we want to have.
Yeah, that's the word covetous and the word jealousy. Both those words have negative connotations, but they're not exclusively used in a negative sense. You know, you think about the way God is jealous for us, and then think about how a husband should feel with regard to his wife, that there should be a jealousy that is there and present. It would be actually inappropriate for there not to be. Now, you talk about, though, the jealous husbands, that they're negative, and jealousy can be a negative and sinful thing in that relationship. But a desire to have your wife as your own is the way Christ is with the church and the way God is with His people. And so those things can be used. So when we talk about rivalry, jealousy, even the word covet, again, you might have someone say, I covet your prayers. What does that mean? I really greatly desire for you to pray for me. And that's not a negative use of that term. They're typically negative, but they're not always. But when we're talking about human rivalry, is in this particular text, indicating when you accomplish something, there is an unhealthy desire on the part of others to either tear you down or to elevate themselves above you. And that's something that is inappropriate. Anything else? Okay, so we took a lot of time. We're certainly not going to do that with all the material that we have, but as I indicated, I've preached sermons using basically a similar list of this. And I think it's a good way to kind of, what we've done is go through the gamut. We haven't actually discussed the two, first two in detail, the remainder of the lesson, so we'll do that now. But all of these things kind of, when you run the gamut of human experience, all the things that you can try in order to gain some value. And he's tried them all, whether it's working, whether it's getting famous, whether it's accomplishing something, whether it's having fun, all of these kinds of things. Learning, which is bullet point number two. That ultimately all those things are vain if God's not in the picture. So that's the point being made. Okay, so now then, let us look under C, and then we'll get into the final two bullet points. So letter C wants to get at the root cause of why he's so pessimistic. And ultimately, it is that point of view of which we speak, life lived under the sun. But I want you to notice when he's talking about these things, existence, wisdom, pleasure, labor, rivalry, greed, fame, wealth, coveting, foolishness, rewards, other than maybe the concept of rivalry, then we could say human success, because rivalry is the response to the success. So you look at those things that are mentioned, basically what you're saying is, okay, here I am, I'm on this earth, and I want what I can get out of life. So what do I look to give me the greatest value and sense of accomplishment, make me happy or fulfilled in life? And that's one of the problems, is that you're living your life selfishly when you think that way. What can I get out of it? I'm convinced that one of the primary reasons why divorce is so rampant in our society is that young people are taught that, and you'll hear it in their language, why did you get married? Well, because I want to be fulfilled, and this is a way in which I can be fulfilled. Or why are you married? Because he is so nice to me, he treats me so well. Why do you like this person? Whatever. And so it's always about, okay, this is what I'm getting out of it. And so whenever an individual enters into a marriage relationship because of what they perceive that they will get out of that relationship, and then they don't get it, then they become disenchanted with it and they want to end it. And of course, we've always taught that the importance for young people to see the reason why you get married is because of what you want to give to the other person. And that's the selflessness. And if two people are selfless, then the bond grows stronger. If two people are selfish, then it's going to break. And that's the point that he makes here in number one, under the causes of the pessimism, is because this guy, when he's describing these things, all of the things in that bullet point, bullet list above, this is all a selfish point of view. What I'm wanting to get something out of life. And the selfishness is the problem. And so he makes the passage in Acts chapter 20 as a contrast. And it's one that has a phrase in it there that you will be familiar with. On this occasion, Acts chapter 20, Paul is talking to the elders of the church of Ephesus. He called them to him when he was on his way to Rome in Miletus, and begins to talk to them in verse 17. And as he's talking, he indicates that as elders, they had a responsibility to the flock, which was among them, to care for them and protect them, to be, in fact, selfless in their service. And he used himself as an example in verse 35. He said, I've shown you in every way by laboring like this. It was, I've shown you how you ought to act by the way I acted when I was around you. You'll remember he was in Ephesus for several years. And he said, so you need to support the weak and remember the words of the Lord Jesus that he said, it's more blessed to give than to receive. So the blessing of life ultimately is to be selfless in outlook rather than selfish. And of course, that makes an individual more successful in his relationships with other individuals, gives him some sense of self-worth that would otherwise not be present if he was living selfishly. And that illustration with regard to what the elders were to do, how they were to conduct themselves, I think fleshes out that point very, very well. So where is the value in life? Is it to get or to give? And the wise man was thinking get. And that's why it was so vain. All right, point one, questions, comments about that? That outlook? I really try to elicit discussions. It just goes against my way I've always preached, always taught. So I'm trying, but if there's something you want to say and I'm not giving you a chance, then raise your hand and we'll certainly give you time. I don't mean to just lecture you. Okay, point number two. So number one, he lives selfishly rather than socially. Second one is that he views life apart from God rather than controlled by Him. And so there's where the point of view comes in. Life that is apart from God, under heaven, under the sun. And he uses Philippians chapter 4 and verse 13. By the way, what is that? It says Philippians 4, 1 through 3. And I think that that's a misprint. I don't think it means Philippians 4, 1 through 3. I think it means Philippians 4, 13. So you may want to make that change in your book. So God is shoved to the background, human achievement to the forefront. Pessimism can't be far behind. And so chapter 4, verse 13, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Christ should be... Because otherwise, because that makes sense. Point of view, with Christ I can accomplish it, but someone who strives to accomplish it without Christ is ultimately going to fail. But I don't see anything in chapter 4, verses 1 through 3 that indicates that at all. So I think 4:13 is what's intended there. When God is shoved to the background, human achievement to the forefront, then pessimism can't be far behind. Paul was in a conditioned state where he understood his dependence upon God. I think sometimes we are not. Anything else? Third point in this. Then he views life as bordered by the grave rather than having a destiny beyond. So, you know, really, 2 and 3 very much tie in with this concept that we're talking about, life lived under the sun. And the illustration of that in chapter 3, in verses 19 through 20. Of all the despairing passages in this entire book, verses 19 and 20, I think, is perhaps the most. What happens to the sons of men also happens to animals. One thing befalls them. As one dies, so dies the other. Surely they all have one breath. Man is no advantage over animals, for all is vanity. All go to one place. All are from the dust. All return to the dust. And you know, I think to myself that people live their lives, their entire lives, without God in the picture, and that's ultimately what it all comes down to. Whenever I preach on this particular topic, I bring up the subject of nihilism. It's a philosophy of thought. A nihilist is an individual who has come to the conclusion as he contemplates life that life has no meaning. And I point out the fact that there are many individuals that they live their lives as humanists. And that's the point of view of the book. Life lived without respect to God. So they live their lives as humanists. They have the idea that there's no God out there to help us. So if we're going to accomplish anything as a people, we're going to have to do it ourselves. And so they spend their life, and they'll maybe dedicate themselves lives to be humanitarians, as humanists, and to strive to better mankind. So they'll start off idealistic when they're young. That's why you've got so many young people that join the Peace Corps, as an example. They want to help people. And they'll give up a year of their life, they'll go overseas and live in squalor and try to help people. And they've been doing it in the Peace Corps since the 1960s, because it was John F. Kennedy that started that group or started that program. And so all of this has been happening. So now where are we? So you have individuals that were, let's say they were 20 in the 60s. So that means they're 75 now, let's say, because I was born in the 60s, so and I'm 55. So let's say they're 75, and it's exactly the way it was. There's still poverty. there is, and I'm not saying they didn't help people, I'm just saying that the world is as it always was. We have the earthquake in Mexico, 55 people killed already that we know of, I think.
I think it's 200. Up to
200 now. Okay, so the last I heard was 55, so up to 200 now. You have all the Houston and Florida and Houston with the hurricanes in Puerto Rico now and wherever it's going to end up. And all of these kinds of things are happening. And really, when we talk and contemplate the plight of man as they live on this earth, it hasn't improved. Technology has made a change. I recognize all that. But ultimately, people still live. People still get sick. People still die. They're still suffering in the world. There's still man's inhumanity of man. There's still wars and rumors of wars. All of these things happen. So what does the humanist do? This idealistic young person goes through and says, okay, in my generation, we're going to change it. We're going to change things. Things are going to be different. At the end of their life, they come to the conclusion that even though they've worked all their lives to try to make changes, that ultimately this world is just as fouled up as it was when they started. And that's when they despair. They come to the point where they think, well, you know, I've worked all my life to effect a change, and really, I'm going to die, and there's no difference. And then, when you get to that point, that's called nihilism. That if there's any value in life, it's to make a change. I'm not able to make the change, so life has no value. And the nihilism is something that is a philosophy that is born out from a purely physical view or viewpoint. So you go through life, and this is all there is, and you live your 80 years, and you die, and there's nothing else. And boy, why was I here? What was the purpose of it? And so that's what he was doing, and that's that life that is lived under the sun. So that's a very pessimistic outlook, because indeed, the accounts are not settled on earth. And the good doesn't come while we live here on this earth. But if we understand and recognize that that's not the case, then things get much better. And that's the final point here before we get into Roman numeral 2, and that is that Solomon's point of view is wrong. And again, remember, it was a device. He understood it was wrong, and he made acknowledgments with regard to its wrongness. But I want you to notice that passage. It's a beautiful passage that I actually wasn't too familiar with. I've heard the phrase in chapter 3 and verse 11. He has made everything beautiful in his time. Also, he has put eternity in their hearts. We need to maybe put that on a blackboard somewhere.
I teach that a lot to the young kids, just to understand that there's something bigger than you yourself.
Yeah.
And that God's plan. Yeah. So that we have something to look forward to.
And if you're not looking for it, there's going to be a void there. And unless you find that, the void will remain. So that's a neat thing. And you wonder about that because you've had an out-and-out attack upon faith that has lasted for at least a generation. I mean, there's been that existence of it for forever. But the cultural elites of our day have come to the conclusion that religion is superstition. And they have attacked it. And our children, it's being attacked. And yet, one of the frustrating things about the secularists of our day is that if you do a Gallup poll for the United States, a decided majority of people still believe in God, despite this attack. But having said that, because it has been several generations that this has happened, in Europe, that's not the case. When you have continental Europe, you have the typical European nations that are fairly prosperous, Great Britain, Germany, France, Spain, Italy. God's not there anymore. And it's really interesting because they look at us as America as really being rather peculiar with our embracing of guns and Bible. It's a weird people. And how ignorant we are because we persist in this view of God. That can change societally. And I think it is. It's a very real danger. But there's a void there that only God can fill. And if he's not in the picture, then it's a shame. Oh, we're past time. Okay, let's just so that you'll know, and we can go on to the next field. Read verses, look at chapter 8, verses 12 and 13. Though a sinner does evil 100 times, and his days are prolonged, Yet I surely know that it will be well with those who fear God, who fear before Him, but it will not be well with the wicked. So it doesn't matter what works on this earth, fearing God. See, He knows that. He understands that now. And then, of course, you get to Ecclesiastes 12 and verse 13. The conclusion of the whole matter, fear God. Keep His commandments. This is man's all. So that's, you know, that's the full circle He came to. He went and tried everything else and nothing worked. So He came to the conclusion and understood the fear of God is what was most important. So ultimately, Solomon got the lesson. And hopefully by studying these things, we'll be able to get that lesson as well. All right? Comments, questions? Okay, well, then we'll pick up with point number two. We'll probably get through the remainder of the first lesson next week. And hopefully we'll have our books for those who don't yet have one.